Hello, I'm Greg Johnston. Welcome to Imagining the Past, the summertime season 2023, and the reading is easy. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this podcast series, we'll be hearing some of the sessions from the 2021 HNSA conference.
The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing, and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a breathtaking $100,000. Divided between the adult and CYA categories.
This session involves Jenny Quinlan, Chair of the Historical Novel Society North America, in conversation with international best-selling authors Kate Quinn and Kate Forsyth, the patron of the Historical Novel Society Australasia.
Hello everyone, welcome to a conversation with Kate Quinn and Kate Forsyth. My name is Jenny Quinlan. I'm chair of the Historical Novel Society North America Conference, and I'm thrilled to be your host for what is sure to be a fabulous conversation about what draws these authors to a particular era of history, their research, and whether they are influenced by the market in selecting a historical period for their next book. And we're saving plenty of time for questions, so if there's something your inquiring mind wants to know, be sure to ask. I may not see all of the questions in the chat box, so for the best chance of having your questions answered, be sure to ask it in the Q&A box. And now, without further ado, let's meet our guests. Kate Quinn is the New York Times and USA Today bestselling author of historical fiction. A native of Southern California, she attended Boston University, where she earned a bachelor's and master's degree in classical voice. She has written four novels in the Empress of Rome saga and two books in the Italian Renaissance, before turning to the 20th century with The Alice Network, The Huntress, and The Rose Coat. All have been translated into multiple languages. Kate and her husband now live in San Diego with three rescue dogs. Kate Forsyth wrote her first novel, age 7, and has sold more than 1 million copies since. Her novels include The Blue Rose, a story of impossible love set in revolutionary France and imperial China, Beauty and Thorns, a reimagining of Sleeping Beauty set amongst the passions and scandals of the pre-Raphaelites, Bitter Greens, a reimagining of Rapunzel, which won the 2015 ALA Award for Best Historical Fiction, and The Wild Girl, the story of the forbidden romance behind the Grimm brothers' famous fairy tales. Kate also has a doctorate in fairy tale studies and is an accredited master storyteller. Welcome, ladies. Let's start by talking about how your story ideas are born. Are you first drawn to an era, an event, or a character? Kate Q, let's start with you.
Lovely to be here, by the way, and waving hello to everybody who is watching. I'm broadcasting from the past if you're in Australia. I'm still in Saturday. Apparently, you're in Sunday. As far as where where my ideas come from, I'm generally drawn to either a person, an event, or a group. And generally, it all revolves in some way around women of the past who have done something astounding, whether it's one woman, whether it's an event in which women participated, or whether it's a group of astounding ladies. It tends to be the achievements of women in the past that somehow hook me and make that light bulb go off in my head. They make me think, yes, I can hang a story on this. Generally, that's it.
Yeah, it's a little bit different for me. For me, it's always the story idea. You know, like Kate, I'm drawn to the stories of women in the past. Bitter Greens began for me because I wanted to retell the fairy tale of Rapunzel, but I wanted to retell it as historical fiction, not as fantasy. I wanted to tell it as if it really happened. I wanted to make it feel really alive, really real, really visceral. I began by wanting to tell it in three strands, like the girl, the witch, and some other narrative thread. And so I went in search of the woman who first wrote the tale and, of course, discovered the astonishing life of Charlotte Rose de Clermont de la Force. That kind of set me off on this quest to find the forgotten stories of real women in history, particularly ones that are involved in things that interest me. Courage, resistance, storytelling, extraordinary lives that deserve to be remembered. So for me, it's always a story idea. And once it infests my imagination, then I find it very, very hard to not give it life.
So let's talk a little bit about research, because I know you guys are both, known for how much you research your novels and how much you put into that. So Kate Forsyth, can you tell us what is the best research advice you've ever received?
The best research advice I've ever received, I think, would probably be from a local historian here in New South Wales, where she said to me, always ask yourself, it might be interesting, but is it relevant? Because I think sometimes you get so fascinated with the people and the times that you are researching, and you want to try and squeeze everything that you've discovered into the book. But in actual fact, you can't and you shouldn't. And so constantly asking yourself, well, it's interesting, yes, but is it relevant? And I always think to myself, well, I'll save it for a blog post and not put it in the book. So I think that was really, really helpful to me. But, you know, I love the research. To me, research is simply reading with a purpose, reading about something that you're fascinated by. So I also have to be careful that I don't get completely lost in the research and follow trails of breadcrumbs in the dark forest and get lost forever. I need to research with purpose and focus.
I really feel that, because there's a whole thing you get into as a writer. It's like where if you went down a rabbit hole and you invested 14 hours into finding out this teeny little fact, and then and you had 14 tabs open on your computer, after a while you get this stubborn feeling of like, damn it, I sunk so much time researching this, it has to go in the book. But the fact is that no, if it isn't advancing the story or the plot or the character, it can't go in the book unless you really have a lot of room to spare. I never have room to spare. So yeah, that's very good advice. And it's advice I still tell myself constantly. I would say the research advice for me is that I just had one I was thinking of, because I had so many ideas that answered this, is that partially as a writer with a deadline, is that at some point the research has to end. And it's one of those things where your agent or your spouse at some point may, you know, be gently required to, you know, tap you on the shoulder and say, you know, it's like, I know you have acquired your 16th biography of Napoleon for the writing of this, but you are aware there's a deadline and it's approaching, right? I mean, there is a time when the research has to end and the writing has to start. So really it is researching with a purpose is a very good way to put it. It has to be relevant to the story. And at some point you have to haul yourself out of that rabbit hole and realize that the story must be written.
Yeah, I often find that I use research when I have that feeling that I'm overwhelmed and I don't know enough. And often I don't know enough about my story, not about the world, but I go and research in the hope that it would help me find out what I need to know about my story. And I think that with experience, you know, having written quite a few books now, you learn to trust the process a lot more and trust in your story and that the answers will come.
I would like to say too, it's like, I will, and this is a hill I will die on, I do not believe in unnecessary research. If you need to go down that rabbit hole to find out something that is critical to your story, then you go down that rabbit hole and you don't come out until you find it. But if I remember going over this with a friend, where she was tying herself in knots about, can I have my heroine, you know, look at the Sears Tower? Was the Sears Tower tall enough at this point for her to see it? At this point, where she's standing in New York City in 1912, or it wasn't the Sears Tower. And I said, wait, before you start pulling up street maps of New York City in 1912, why don't you just say she looked in the direction of the Sears Tower, which means that's accurate enough and you don't have to go down the rabbit hole. And that's the kind of thing I have learned to do, that sometimes will save you 5 hours worth of pawing through maps that are in like 0.02 font in PDF, and because it's all for one line, and if you can end run around it, you save yourself the time, and it is still historically accurate. So I will say, do not do research that you don't have to do, because we're all nerds. We will go down those rabbit holes at the slightest provocation. Sometimes this is not always to the story's advantage.
So true.
So if I could just piggyback on that a little bit, because I have a feeling this is a question that's going to come up. How do you know when it's time to stop the research and start the writing? Or are you researching and writing at the same time?
Which Kate do you want to go first?
Well, you're speaking, so let's start with you.
I don't always know, but in general, I know I'm ready to write when I feel that my characters are alive in my imagination and are speaking in their own voices, and that I have a strong sense of my story's shape and my key scenes in it. I don't necessarily know everything that's going to happen in the book, not at all, but I have the skeleton of my story, and my characters are so alive, they're eager to get started. So pretty much as soon as the scenes start presenting themselves to me in words, I begin writing. Sometimes it's early on in the writing process, and sometimes it takes me a long time. Each book is different, but in general, once the words are there, tingling in my fingertips, I start writing.
I tend to think I research throughout, and it really depends on what stage of the process I'm in. When you're at the beginning, you're sort of daisy chaining around looking for, you know, your topic, maybe looking for the things that will go into the book. And that's when you're sort of going from article to article, you know, free associating madly your way through Wikipedia articles and online articles and various books in the library. And then after that, you do your focus deep dive when it's like, all right, you know what your story is going to be. Now you're doing that dive into everything you can find. This is where you are, in fact, reading 16 biographies of Napoleon, because Napoleon's, you know, reign is when your story is, and you want as much of that information as possible. And then I generally start writing when I have the feeling of familiarity in the world that I'm in, because the thing about writing in an era is that it's not about looking up the big dates of history. You can find those. They're easy to find for the most part. The stuff that you really need to make a world come alive is the little minutiae of life. The things where it's like, do I have the feeling when I'm about to start writing, do I know what a dinner menu of the time is going to look like for this particular demographic of society that your heroine is eating in? You know, do I know what, you know, the floor, basically what the flora and fauna is? Do I have an idea of like, what would a tip be for tea for two at this time? What does the money look like? What is a daughter's dowry? What does a loaf of bread cost? You know, these are the teeny things that are hard to find. And if you start to feel finally like you have an air of familiarity with that daily life detail, even if you still have to look up little things, that's generally when I feel I'm about ready to start writing, is when that world starts to feel alive, not in the broad strokes, but in the little details of daily life.
It's like, I always like to know, do they wear underwear? Where do they pee? And what do they, you know, what songs do they sing to their babies? That's the sort of thing that I like to know, the kind of social history. And that, and particularly with women's lives, that's often not really recorded. And that's the sort of thing that you can't find in archaeology. So often it's really hard to find those things. But the quest to find them can be fascinating.
Really can be. And you can find it in the weirdest ways. Like, you know, that, you know, archaeology made me think of it. But, you know, we learn so much about what toys children play with because of graves, because children are buried with favorite toys. And that got dismissed for the longest time as hen scholarship, because it's talking about children's toys and how can that be scholastically important? Well, you know, it's certainly important to novelists.
I always think that a novelist is only as good as their research library. And so I collect books. I have one called The Life of P, which is a history of urine throughout the world. I've got another one on the history of children's play, because I'm really interested in how university children's play. I have an encyclopedia of the home, you know, what homes look like throughout history. That's the kind of stuff that I love to collect.
Yeah. So what's the most fun you've ever had researching a novel? KQ, let's start with you.
Oh, I really enjoyed researching the Rose Code in some ways. In some ways it was maddening, but because there was a lot of it. But I did really enjoy the Rose Code because I actually did go to Bletchley Park and I walked those grounds, and they have these grounds, you know, mocked up to look the way they would have looked in Bletchley Park's heyday. So it really did feel like I was walking right into the past. And that was just, it chills all over. You know, I really recommend anyone who can go to the UK in any point in the future, take a day trip to Bletchley Park. It's wonderful. And also the Rose Code had the funniest research story, or one of them, that I've ever had, which is that I actually worked for this book with a Bletchley Park researcher, an independent researcher whose specialty was the women of Bletchley Park, because there was so much to get wrong there. I really wanted someone to help me find those errors. And God bless her. She wrote me my very proper, very civilized British scholar wrote me an email saying, you know, listing mistakes, and she just says, you know, this, you know, that you have this one scene where your characters are meeting up for, you know, a mid-shift quickie, you know, a little quick sex on the noon break, and you haven't happened in the mansion in, you know, like a book closet, and I really think the traffic would be a little busy in the hallway, so have you considered moving the sex down to the air raid cellar instead, which is not much in use in 1944? And she included floor maps with floor plans, and I just sat there just going, this is okay. Well, I listened to my researcher. The mid-shift quickie is duly moved to the air raid cellar. And I'm very glad indeed that my people can have it in peace now and not get caught by the hall traffic.
Experts in their field, don't you love them?
Oh, yes.
So I've loved the research for every single one of my books, but I think Peter Green's probably wins because it's set in Renaissance Venice. And in, in Versailles and Paris during the reign of the Sun King. So I traveled with my three children who were then aged 7, 11 and 12 or something like that. And we went for a month. And so, you know, we got to, you know, walk, drift around Venice and eat and drink our way through Italy. And we, Charlotte Rose de Caumont de la Force was born in a chateau in Gascony. I got a private tour by the, one of her sister's descendants. The chateau's been in the family ever since the time of the 17th century or 16th century. So I got a private tour. That was amazing. So pretty much an excuse to travel to Italy and France. I think, you know, that might have been a subconscious drive in me to write that book.
Yeah. So let's shift gears a little bit. Have any of your friends or loved ones ever made their way into your novels?
I'm going to answer that one first, simply because the answer is yes. But that's because I write children's books as well as adult books. I wrote a lot of children's books for my own children as they were growing up. So I have a very small early reader series called Ben and Tim's Magical Misadventures, which my sons are called Ben and Tim. So here in Australia, I don't know if you do this in America, but we have a thing called Book Week, and they have a book parade, and all the kids come dressed up as their favorite characters from books. And so, like, you have 90 Harry Potters and, you know, a dozen Anne of Green Gables and a few Pippi Longstockings. Anyway, my son just used to go as himself, wearing the T-shirt that he appears on the cover, and he'll just walk around going, yeah, you know, I'm so cool because I get to come as myself because I'm in a book.
That's very cool.
I can answer this question yes as well. I have had people turn up in my books, and that's because one of my very favorite games to play whenever you're at, you know, a meeting that is boring, or, you know, a large family function where everyone's talking and you're sort of in your own head. One of my favorite games to play is to look around the room and decide what historical era do each of these people belong in? And it's amazing what that pops up with. I mean, like, I looked at my grandmother and, you know, my very feminist socialisted, you know, progressive grandmother, step-grandmother, and I thought she would absolutely be a 19th century suffragette chaining herself to the railings of, you know, number 10 Downing Street in a fabulous hat and shouting votes for women. You know, it's like I looked at, and then, you know, I looked at, you know, my own mom was, you know, a Bennett, who is a you know, retired librarian with, you know, dogs and books and, you know, an herb garden. I thought you would be a Benedictine nun with like a forbidden cat in your cell and, you know, a series of books under the bed. And it's like all these things. And sometimes this gives me a character that I'll think, you know, that could make an actual great character for a book. And actually, my husband's grandmother made her way as one of the heroines into my Italian Renaissance series. Because I looked at her, she was this tiny Sicilian force of nature who was one of the best cooks I've ever known, who would absolutely, you know, whack you over the head with a wooden spoon if you committed the sin of breaking the pasta into the pot instead of folding it. And I just thought, who would you be? And then I thought you would be like the head cook to the Borgias in the Renaissance Rome. And I thought, bingo. And so she became the head cook to the Borgia Pope's mistress in The Serpent and the Pearl, and very much the same kind of character. And I even used her name Carmelina, which was her real name before it got anglicized to Mildred, which is the terrible thing to do to a name like Carmelina. But I did tell her that, and she was so delighted. And so she's the one who's made it the most into any of my books. But I do recommend that game of going around the room and placing people in historical eras. It's a lot of fun.
I have a feeling everyone who is listening now is going to be playing that game the next time they're at a tedious function.
Oh, it kills time like nothing. It's great.
I often borrow just one small element from someone and give it to a character so that their character is not them, but they have something about it. Now, Kate, I remember after I read the Alice Network, I wrote to you because your main character there has a stutter, which is something that I have struggled with all of my life, years and years and years and years of speech therapy. And I wrote to you going, okay, I love this book so much because it's the first time I've ever seen a starring role given to someone who struggles with a stutter. And you told me that your husband stutters as well. And I found that so incredibly moving.
Yeah, that, you know, boy, I can't believe I didn't think of that as my first example. I thought it was grandmother first. But yes, Eve in the Alice Network is, you know, her speech impediment was actually suggested by my husband when I was, you know, sort of fleshing her character out, because I wanted to give her, you know, some various qualities that might, you know, make her job more difficult, or maybe in a sense make it easier. And he said, well, why not give her a stutter like me? And it made its way in beautifully because, you know, I've been married to him for a long time. I've been with him even longer before that. And I've seen the way that people interacted with him, the way he interacted with the world with a speech impediment. And these are things that I put in. And he helped me fine tune her dialogue, you know, so hopefully I could make it as accurate as I could.
It felt real to me. It really did. Yeah.
Mm. I'm so glad, you know, because, you know, we both worked on that. And in the end, it felt like a kind of victory that I had a character who took something that, you know, had been causing problems for her whole life, and which many people would regard as, you know, a disability, and instead she weaponized it, and she made it an ability, you know, something that she used as a spy. She used it to make people underestimate her to their cost.
Yeah. So, you know, I've given characters my stutter before, and the book that I've just finished writing also has a stuttering hero. But, you know, usually people who stutter are portrayed as kind of comic relief, not as real people with real struggles. And so I loved that. We've kind of gone off
subject. Either that or they're psychopaths. The stuttering psychopath is a cliche I would really like to see retired.
Yeah, Criminal Minds has done it at least twice. The psychopathic stutterer. Jenny, keep us on track.
Okay, well, we're okay. Okay, but we are going to switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about the historical fiction marketplace. So, Kate Quinn, you moved from writing ancient and Renaissance fiction to the 20th century. And Kate Forsyth, you also made the move from your fairy tale based fiction to the 20th century. But your next book, if I'm correct, is a Greek myth retelling, which seems to be an emerging trend. So tell us, how much does the marketplace affect your decisions? Kate Forsyth, let's start with you.
Okay, so it's quite a big question and quite a complex one. For me, I write the story that is most thrilling me, most exciting me. I don't choose a setting and then set my book then. But then there are a certain periods of history that I'm naturally drawn to. So, you know, Bitter Greens, as I said, is set in Renaissance Venice. And I've always been interested in that period of time. And so, you know, I've always wanted to write something set there. I haven't really moved. All of my books have a mythic or fairy tale quality through them. So it's an extension of what I'm already doing. The Wild Girl, I mean, honestly, no one in their right mind would have thought that a book about the Grimm brothers set in a small German town during the Napoleonic Wars, that's not a sexy place and not a sexy time, unlike Renaissance Venice. But then, you know, that was where the story I wanted to tell was set. So I couldn't transpose it to Paris. So for me, I follow the idea, but you must remember that I have 1,000 ideas. I have more ideas than I could ever write. Whenever I get an idea, I scribble it down. And then when it's time for me to write a new book, I go to my agent first. We have a strategy meeting. We look through some of my ideas and we choose what we think is going to be easiest to write and sell. So, you know, a couple of times I've had ideas and my agent, or my publisher have gone, yeah, no, let's, you know, but I normally present them with a couple of different ideas and then we toss and, you know, my agent will go, oh, I love the sound of that one. And so that helps me get excited. Does that make sense? So it's, yeah. I'm aware of the market. I'm strategic in how I plan what I'm going to write next, but I never write solely because I'm hoping to catch a fashion in the publishing industry. I think that's the best way to say it.
That's well put.
I think I do something really quite similar. I always have far more ideas to write than I will ever have time to write. And so it becomes quite often a bit about thinking about what is catching my imagination. What do I want to write right now? I try not to hone in on just one. I try to have a few possibilities, and I have that similar talk with my agent, maybe my editor, and we think about what would be strategically important, you know, what would be strategically smart going forward. For me, it is about finding the Venn diagram sweet spot between the overlap between what you feel passion about writing and what the market is selling. You find that spot in the middle and you can find it. And I do not think it is in any way selling out to look for that. Because when you're writing professionally, when it's no longer a hobby, you do have to think about what sells. You do have to think about what the market wants. And the fact is that if you only have one idea as a storyteller and it's that idea or nothing, you're not going to get very far. So periodically, all of us, you know, every writer I know has at some point heard that you can't tell that story right now. Maybe it's because, you know, someone else just sold a very similar idea, yeah. And you're going, oh, damn it, you know, so you have to put that away or try to reimagine it to be something different enough so that you can do it. Or maybe it's because, you know, people just aren't reading about this stuff right now. So maybe you need to, again, find a way to reimagine it or just put it under the bed until the trends change, because book trends change quickly. Uh-huh. You know, some trends might be around for years, but others come and go faster. So there are ideas that I've had where my editor said, I'm not sure we can do that. And I just tend to think, all right, it goes back under the bed until the market changes.
Yeah, that's exactly how I think that one. I love your metaphor of the Venn diagram, because that's exactly how it works for me. It's a kind of balancing act between, you know, what's the best book to write now. Now, I'm an ex-journalist as well. So, you know, during my 20s, I made my living as a journalist, and I still write a lot of essays and articles just for my own pleasure. We were always taught to think about what is timely, you know. If you're a freelance journalist and you're pitching ideas all the time to magazines and newspapers, you're always looking for the timely angle. And that's kind of what I do when I'm pitching ideas to my agent and publisher as well. I think what feels relevant now, and that helps me narrow my focus on what I'm doing. And it also helps me sell. If I have an idea that's not so sexy, I find an angle that's going to make it sexy. in order to sell it properly?
Sometimes it's a matter of if you have something that does not, that maybe is an era that isn't selling as well, can you find a way to wrap your not quite on trend topic in some sort of sparkly ribbons that make it more appealing?
Exactly.
Like I thought that, for example, it was Laura Morelli's The Night Portrait. She had done these Renaissance books that were great. And then she wrapped a World War II art theft story about it. So you had the story of the painting and the woman in the painting in the Renaissance. And then you had the World War II art theft. And I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was such a brilliant idea. I was sitting there going, my God, I wish I had thought of that. Because, you know, it really was a way to wrap, you know, something that's very on trend, World War II art theft, and then put that around a story that maybe would not be seen quite as on trend, which might be, you know, an all Renaissance story. And I thought that just melded it beautifully. And, you know, I think that book has done very well.
I haven't actually heard of it, but I've actually just made a note of it because that sounds like my kind of book. I'm gonna go read it now.
Oh, dude, it's wonderful. Mm.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you guys one more question before we turn it over to our audience questions. So what advice would you give to a writer who is trying to break into the historical fiction market today?
I can start with that if you'd like.
Okay, go for it.
Given that I already did the advice of, like, you know, find that Venn diagram sweet spot between what is selling and what is selling and, you know, what you can be passionate about. That's one. I would say that flexibility and adaptability is the name of the game. That is what will get you ahead as a writer of any kind, not just historical fiction. But the thing is, I learned that, I think, when my very first agent said to me, in her experience, 50% of new writers sink themselves because they either cannot or will not make changes to their book baby in order to get it into a publishable state. And this is not to say that, like, you need to take every single bit of advice that you are given by your editor and follow it blindly. You know, it is always a conversation. But the fact is that if you approach feedback with an automatic reflexive, no, I can't make changes. No, this book is done. It's done enough editing. I'm not doing any more. That is, you are going to sink yourself. You need to be willing to approach editing like a dialogue, and you need to be willing sometimes to do things that maybe you don't find palatable. Like I was told with my very first book, it's way too long. You need to cut something like 50,000 words out of it, and you have something like 12 viewpoints. Can you get it down to 6? And that was not particularly nice to hear, but I looked at it and I saved a copy of it and I put it away and said, okay, just in case this advice is wrong, but I did it. It was a much better book for it. And that ended up being the book that got published. So be flexible, be adaptable, and do not be rigid when it comes to accepting advice, because this is going to have to be a team effort.
Yeah, I think that's actually excellent advice. And it's, you know, what I tell people all the time. I always say, listen and learn. You know, you have the opportunity to work with incredible editors that and who can bring a fresh, clean eye to your story. And you will grow as a writer if you can learn to listen, and if you can, you know, take on board what is said to you. The other thing that I think is really, really important is actually to read a great deal, read in the market, read what is being published, read what is winning awards and selling masses of it, and then think and try and learn from them as well. You know, read mindfully, rather than just reading, you know, only for pleasure. They read for pleasure as well.
So totally, we've got a lot of...
Read a lot. Go ahead. Totally, yeah. Second that. Read a lot, because reading primes the pump for creativity. If you stop reading, you're going to be stopping priming that pump. And it's also the fact that you never know when something is going to give you inspiration. I remember I found the key to... like the crucial character key I had been looking for, which had been driving me crazy, to one of my ancient Rome novels. I found that reading a sci-fi novel. It's something in reading a science fiction novel that could not have been more different from the historical ancient Roman period. There was a similar kind of character thing in there. There was a turn, clicked in my head, everything became clear. And you never know when that's going to happen, but it's going to happen when you read other people's books.
We've got a lot of questions, so let's go ahead and switch over to that and get into some of the questions that our audience members have asked. A lot of these are dealing about the marketplace and writing, but a couple are a little more specific, so I'm going to start with those. There's one for each of you. So, Kate Quinn, what resources did you find when you were researching your intelligences and codes?
There's no shortage of stuff about Enigma codes and code breaking out there. There are YouTube videos. There are many, many war memoirs, people who either wrote biographies of code breakers during the war or code breakers who themselves wrote books about the work that they did, about their time at Bletchley Park. There is a lot. I actually included a list of nonfiction in the back of the Rose Code if you find it there. But there was so much. If you just look up a couple of sources, you can also then look on, you know, Amazon and various other places, because it'll start suggesting people who bought X also bought Y. That is deadly for your one-click order button, but it is also very useful.
Kate Forsyth, you mentioned lullabies earlier when you were talking, and someone would like to know, what do you do when a lullaby that you're searching for that maybe you've heard of is not recorded? You know, how do you still weave it into your story? Do you make it up?
I often do. It depends what period of history I'm researching, because the further back in time you go, the harder the research is, basically. I often make things up. So I write spells and charms and curses and songs, which I really enjoy doing. Sometimes I adapt things. My doctorate is in fairy tales, but it's actually in, let's say, units of cultural information. So I'm really good at searching back recipes, songs, riddles, nursery rhymes, and fairy tales and myths. They're all kind of related in how they are packaged and travel throughout history. But, you know, I mean, for example, in Bitter Greens, it's full of curses. I read the trial transcripts of Renaissance Venice witch hunts, because they were actually all the spells that the common people were using were recorded. And so I used those and adapted those as well. So it depends. If I can't find it, I'll make it up.
So this is a question both of you can answer. Do either of you have a story you have written or an idea you really loved that you were really proud of, but you have not been able to publish it? And if so, can you tell us about it?
I can answer that. The answer is yes. I had a book that was right before the Alice Network that I really wanted to sell, and it just wasn't quite right. I put that back under the bed, and honestly, I am doing the Laura Morelli thing, and I'm going to find a more sparkly ribbon. I found a more sparkly ribbon to wrap around it, and I think that book is probably going to come out. It's not in the queue yet, but I am going to find a way to put it out there because I love it. It's just as a matter of trying to find a different packaging for it, a different way to present it, so that it will be a little bit more on trend for whenever I need to present it. But I am determined I'm going to get it out there. Now, I'm not going to say what it's about because that's still sort of very close to me. So I can't say anything about it yet or I'll jinx it.
Yeah. You know, I think that, you know, we're career writers, we're professional writers. We make our living from creating stories. And most writers I know have brainstorms where they have ideas and they think how brilliant it would be. So there are definitely ideas that I've pitched to my agent or my publisher, and they've gone, no, I'm more excited about this other idea of yours. And then I kind of go, oh, my poor little book, I'm sorry, sweet pea, your time is not yet, but I'm just going to tuck you away in my bottom drawer and one day I might be able to give you life. And then time might pass and my excitement over that idea kind of fades a little bit, or else I find another way of doing it. I do it in a different way that, and then I realize that was a better idea all along. So I just, you know, I always think that inspiration is like a little flame and you've got to feed it. And if you don't feed it, then the idea kind of, you know, sputters out. But sometimes ideas are like little glow worms, and they just glow in the back of your mind for a very, very long idea. And you just wait till the time is right. Sometimes I think when I'm a really old woman, I'll write this idea, because by that time I can just, I'll have plenty of time and I'll be too old to travel and do exciting things. So I'll save that idea for when I can spend hours doing arcane research. Let's see, how many books we write depends on how long our life is. So, you know, I hope to be writing up until the moment I die, but I really, really hope that I type the end and then die.
I want to have Robert B. Parker's death. He wrote all the way up till he died. He had died very quickly of a stroke or a heart attack at his desk while writing. And then the book came out a few months later. And I think that is the way we all want to go.
Yeah, that's how I want to go. But after finishing
the conversation, Morbid.
I was going to say, sort of backtracking a little bit from the topic of death, I just want to say that I think it's great that you're both so positive about having stories you want to write that either the market's not quite ready for, or that you might feel aren't quite ready to be out there. Because I think that's something a lot of writers need to hear. You know, they may be really attached to an idea. And I think it's great to hear both of you talking about how, you know, you've learned that it's not no forever, it's just no for now, and it will have its time when the time is right.
Yeah, so the book I'm working on now, the book I'm working on now, Psyche, 10 years ago, no one really wanted a retelling of a myth. And now they're kind of hot. And so Psyche was an idea that I pitched a long time ago. Nobody wanted, and now everybody wants it. So
again, it comes down to adaptability. You need to be adaptable. You need to be able to pivot. I think that is the ultimate thing that will get you ahead as a writer. If you're trying to make it.
So stemming a little bit from what we've been talking about the marketplace and what's hot and what's not, this is an interesting question. So when talking about when you have these conversations with your agent or publisher about determining which of your book ideas is the next one to go with, do you know what principles they're using, or is it just purely their expert knowledge of market trends that only they would know? And if that's the case, this is the real meat of the question. What can aspiring emerging authors do when they don't have that guidance of an agent or publisher that you have?
Okay, so one of the things that I do is when I'm pitching, like, you know, I don't write a book and then pitch the book. I pitch an idea. And part of what I do is I do my own kind of market research. So I look to see what else is being published that's like my idea. I look to see how well it's been received in the market, you know, who's been writing it, if they won the women's prize or if they won this or that. And then I pitch, I have a little paragraph in the bottom of my synopsis where I say, I imagine this book being much like Kate Quinn's The Rose Code, or someone else that I know that my agents and publishers will, because they have market knowledge, will go, oh, now I can imagine what this book is going to be like. And so that helps my publisher do her research. When she takes my idea to acquisitions meeting, she can go, well, it's going to be like this book. And they can look up the sales figures of those books and they can go, okay, there's a market for that book. We're willing to invest in it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that, because you don't necessarily need a publisher or a editor or an agent to, you know, explain the to read the mysteries of the trend of book trends, like, you know, an auger reading bird entrails. It's out there. It's just a matter of looking at it. So I would say, like, this is why you're on Bookstagram. This is why you're part of the book Twitter conversation. I'm not saying you have to be in all those forms of social media, but keep track of wherever you like your social media, or wherever you are hanging out with book people online, which you probably are if you're here. Look at what are the covers you keep seeing? What are the books you keep seeing? What are the titles that you're seeing? What are the things that are popping up in award discussions? What are the trends that you're observing? If you are watchful and you're looking around at that, you will start to see trends and you will start to be able to analyze that yourself. I'm not saying it's, you know, trends are a little bit crazy. I mean, it is kind of like trying to find patterns in, you know, a goldfish bowl, but you will start seeing some patterns and you, in the book market, not in a goldfish bowl, and you will be able to look at some of those things on your own. And, you know, hopefully by being part of the conversation, wherever it's happening, you know, you can get an idea for, are these things going to still be around for a while? Do you think, are they still around? Have they been around for a long time? What are we seeing? I mean, I think you can figure this out without having an agent or an editor. It's just a matter of being part of the conversation, and looking for comps is very smart because that tells people, if you're submitting, it tells agents and editors that you've done your research. And if you're looking for comps, you need to look for stuff that's recent. I remember an agent I know who said, if you're pitching inspirational Christian literature, do not compare it to Redeeming Love. That title is 30 years old. You know, it's telling me that you're not current in the conversation. You need to be current on what is selling in your genre now or in the last year.
And not just that, keep an eye on what is being made into films and TV as well. Once upon a time, books were the leading indicator, and films and you know, popular culture was following books. But it's the other way around now, because books take too long to write. So if you can see that everyone is watching, let's say, for example, The Queen's Gambit, you know, you will, or let's say Downton Abbey, when Downton Abbey became enormously popular, we suddenly had a hunger in the market for books that were set in that kind of period of history, and that had similar things. So keep an eye not just on what's happening in books, but what's happening in popular culture as a matter of, you know, and this means fashion. This means, you know, music. Everything talks about zeitgeist moments. And so you need to be awake and aware in the world to understand what's happening.
A great comp that recently came up was Gabriella Saab's book about the, why am I blanking on the title? Gabriella Saab's release about a young Jewish girl who is playing chess for her life during when she is imprisoned in a camp. And so her comp was Tattooist of Auschwitz meets The Queen's Gambit. That is a great comp because Tattooist of Auschwitz is still a recent bestseller. And Queen's Gambit is a recent popular movie hit. One is a TV series. That's a very good comp. That's a good way to put a comp together.
Yeah. Let's switch a little bit to talk about your writing habits. Do you work on more than one book at one time, or do you stick with one book from start to finish?
Well, I would prefer to only work on one book at a time, but in general, they overlap a little bit. So, for example, I've finished writing The Crimson Thread, which is a World War II book set in Crete, which, you know, draws upon the mythology of the Minotaur in the Labyrinth. That book is finished, but I'm still waiting for my editorial report, which can actually take weeks or even months. And so while that's happening, I've already sold my next book. I'm doing the research and the early work on that. As soon as I get my editorial report back, I'll have to switch back from ancient mythology into World War II, you know, resistance fighters. And the other thing that I do is often when I finish a major work, I write small things, stories and essays, because I'm constantly writing. So I'm also working on a collection of fairy tale retellings, which, you know, I might write one a week when I've got time, while I'm waiting to get back my editorial report. So, you know, they overlap.
I'm pretty much the same. I cannot draft two different books at the same time. I know some people who do, but they tend to be people who write books in different genres. Like you might be writing a historical and a romance at the same time, but different genres keep things separate. I can't really do that. But generally speaking, the way the publishing cycle goes, I always have things at different stages. So, you know, it'll be the kind of thing where you might be drafting one thing, going over edits on the last thing, review on the last thing that you finished, publicizing the thing before that, and then thinking about the next thing, and then researching the thing that might come after that thing. So that's like five or six things in the head at once, which is why most writers appear a little scatterbrained.
What do you find the hardest aspect of writing? And I think this question answer finds endings difficult. So they'd also like to know if you have any tips on crafting a book ending.
Okay, endings are hard. I always say that a story is like an ubris. It's a snake that bites its own tail. And so you really want your ending to in some way be shine a light back to the very beginning of your book as well. And so that helps me when I'm trying to think of how my book is going to be ending. I want it to have this sense of really strong connection to how the book began. I nearly always have happy endings for my books, and so that makes it easier for me. I think I want my readers to close my book and go, and then I want them to go and start reading the book again because they loved it so much. And so I spend quite a lot of time thinking about how I'm going to end. Quite often, I don't start writing till I have a really clear end point, like I know what my crisis and resolution is going to be. But I do understand that people struggle with endings. I think the worst thing you can do is have a flat ending, one that does not make your reader feel anything. It doesn't matter what they feel. It doesn't matter if they're choking back tears or if they're smiling or even if they're angry, as long as they're feeling something.
I think the part of the process I struggle with most is like that first round of fixes. Because at that point, I'm so close to the book that it feels like a great slog, and it tends to be something too where it's a little bit hard to do that first round, because that's the point when the first draft feels so sparkly, and then it goes out to my critique partners and it comes back, and I sometimes hear things like, your whole viewpoint here is not working, or like, this whole character needs a complete re-evaluation, and that's not fun to hear. But it's always turned out that discussion, again, flexibility, adaptability, enter that discussion, figure it out, hash it out, and then however badly it is, you got to write it out. So I think that first part is that first draft, after the first draft, it's like that first edit is, I think, the hardest for me. Quite often I find out that there will be something I did wrong in terms of a character arc. And that's not usually plot. The ending of the plot part is not so bad. I know where the plot is going to end. But quite often, something about it will feel flat because I haven't arced the characters sufficiently. Because the character's change has to be what really underpins the ending of the plot points. And so quite often, I'll end up doing a whole rethink where I think, well, quite often it'll be something like, what is this character's belief that has to change? Is it, maybe I had the whole idea is like that her belief is I'm not good enough. And actually it turned out that she does think she's good enough. So what is her belief that has to change? Maybe it's, something else instead. And then I have to go through a whole reevaluation of what the character wants and what they really need. And it might be something along those lines. And when I get that right, that is when the ending not just is there, but feels satisfying in the way that KF talked about.
We have tons of questions, and I'm sorry, everybody watching, we're just not going to have time to answer all of them, but I do think we've got time for two more. So first up, who are your inspirations as writers, and what is the one book that will never leave your bookshelf?
Well, I have about 6,000 books, and my husband, I have books arriving on my doorstep every single day, because I have, this kind of very expensive book addiction. And my husband every now and again says to me, come on, can't we just get rid of a few to make room for a few more? And I go, no, I need them all 6,000 books. So I need all of my books, and no one is getting rid of them. The authors that inspire me fall into two camps. One are the authors that I read and loved growing up, which my childhood and my adolescence. And one of the authors that I read now, and I read someone's book and I'm so humbled by how brilliant they are, and it inspires me to try harder to do better. So I have on my website a blog called The 50 Authors Who Shaped Me. And I've chosen 10 authors for every decade of my life. I know that's telling you how old I am, but, and so you can go and read that and you'll find out, you know, that's 50 authors who I think had powerful shaping influences upon my my imagination and also on my idea of who I wanted to be as a writer. I particularly love authors who write, who inspire me to write better. So I love Kate, of course. I love all of her books. The books that I've been reading, the writers who really inspired me in the past few years have been Sarah Waters, Madeline Miller, Emma Donoghue, Maggie O'Farrell, I've just discovered recently. I'm trying to think who else has really inspired me recently. Pat Barker is a new discovery of mine. Many women writers, because I'm interested in women's stories. I don't know, Kate, what about you?
I feel like I'll be here all day if I'm listing the colleagues who I know personally whose stories have, you know, influenced me so much. The thing I think that the ones that really got me hooked when I was younger, who remain in my, you know, wheelhouse and whose books I will always have on my shelf, to answer that second part of the question, will be, I got hooked on Sally Watson's YA historical fiction books like Lark and Linnet. When I was a kid, it was these, you know, incredibly smart, well-researched books with these very young heroines who still managed to have, you know, they were age-appropriate adventures, but they were not sanitized. They were realistically written. And I loved those, and they were terrifically funny. It was almost about young women being clever and using their wits to get around, get what they wanted and get around in the world. Judith Merkel Riley, all of her works, because she was the one who really showed me historical fiction could be funny. And I think it is a failing of our genre at times that it can be deadly, deadly serious. So very earnest. And Judith Merkel Riley always had so much humor in her novels. I love them very much for that. And I love Bernard Cornwell because he writes the best battle scenes in the business. And his battles aren't just crunching bone and flying blood. They have poetry. And it shows you that really anything can be poetic, even violence in books. So those are just some of the books that I have on my shelf, which will never leave me, and which, you know, authors that I love.
Wonderful.
And I have so many as well.
One last question, and I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit with this, but I think it's a great question. And we're going to end with this sort of chance to toot your own horn a little bit. What do you think you've brought to the historical fiction genre that is unique or fresh?
Fairy dust? I don't know.
Can we answer this for each other? Because I think what...
Yes, that's a great idea. Let's do that. Yep.
What Kate Forsythe brought, I remember, and if you were at the Portland conference, you will remember this. She told the story of Tam Lin out loud. Yep. And I have never seen so many people forget that they had cell phones in my entire life. It's like everybody's literally going like... You know, they're listening to her tell this story, and it's nothing but her voice and gestures. And it really did remind me that the power of story really did, in its essence, go back to people, you know, prehistoric peoples possibly sitting around a campfire, one person telling a tale, and everyone else leaning in around the fire saying, "And what happened next?" Which is why I think that I think that's so important to remember, because there's so many forms that books take now. There's ebooks, there's, you know, on there's paper books, there's hardbacks, there's audiobooks, and sometimes there's these whole really didactic discussions about what is real reading and what isn't. Kate reminded me, and what she brought it to it, is that it's all about people leaning in, no matter what form the story takes, and saying, "What happened next?" That is the fairy dust, and that is the magic of the storytelling. So you have brought fairy dust.
Thank you, darling Kate.
That is fantastic. I was at Portland. I remember it vividly, the story of Tam Lin. And I was actually thinking about it today in preparation for this session. Okay, Kate Forsythe, 2 minutes. Tell us Kate Quinn's got.
You know, I think warmth and wit are Kate's great, great gifts, particularly the wit. I love what she said about, you know, how deadly serious so many books can be. But, you know, what I want in a book is to be moved to tears and made to laugh and made to gasp with surprise. And Kate's one of those authors that always does that for me. So I feel like I feel all the feels. It's not very articulate, but I feel so much. And also the books are so, so immersive that when I'm reading, I forget that I'm reading. It's as if I'm watching a movie or I'm actually in the scene. And that is a great gift, I think.
Fantastic. Well, everybody, we are just about out of time. I want to thank all of you for tuning in today. This has been such a fun conversation. I know I had a great time. I learned a lot. I hope you did as well. And thank you so much, Kate and Kate, for being here today.
Love you. Love you. Hope to see you in person very, very soon. And thank you all for joining us.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, Summer Season 2023. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive where you'll find interviews with many alumni. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's hip and happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.